Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The COVID pandemic has killed more than 567,000 Americans and more than 3 million worldwide, as nearly half of Americans have received at least one vaccination shot. This as air travel rebounds in the United States. Another story in Europe, where Germany is and many other nations continue to struggle. President Biden has announced that U.S. troops would be withdrawing from Afghanistan by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. He is also imposing sanctions on Russia. The administration has also backed the decision by its predecessor to sell F-35 fighters, as well as Reaper unmanned aircraft to the United Arab Emirates. Joining us, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the Independent Equity Research Firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Alafia of the Teal Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us again.
Hi, Vago. Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you, Vago. Always a pleasure.
Happy Sunday, Vago.
Happy Sunday to you, Richard. Always just a great part of the week to get a chance to talk to you. Guys, before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, General Motors sponsors our coverage of technology, and Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Ron, talk to us a little bit about the broader market, but also how the group fared this week, especially in the wake of the administration's announcements of the Afghanistan pullout, Russia sanctions, as well as the UAE decisions, which certainly come as good news for both Lockheed Martin and as well as our sponsor, General Atomics.
Yeah, so it was an interesting market week. We saw the 10-year yield pull back a little bit. And in light of that, why that's interesting is really the big story this week, I think, from a market perspective, was you had the big money center banks reporting. So, you know, Bank of America, Chase, JP Morgan, and then some of the, you know, the investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And sort of what we saw across the board there were, you know, the banks beat numbers. A lot of that had to do with reversing reserves that they took. Reserving for, you know, the potential impact of the pandemic. And so, you know, the financial system seems like it's in good shape. Everybody beat. You know, the market was, I think optimistic this week. We hit new highs in the market indices. When you look at aerospace and defense in general, the group broadly drifted higher. We saw another week of defense performing well. And like I said, I think on the podcast last week, my conversations with investors have broadened out. Just a quarter ago, everything was focused on commercial aerospace. Now the focus has changed. It's a broader focus. Not that investors aren't just thinking about commercial aerospace, but they're thinking about other things including defense. And I think we've seen that in the market multiples. If you look at the major U.S. defense companies, most of their stocks have rallied off the bottom. If you look at the relative multiple of U.S. defense, it was at a generational low, almost half the market multiple. And we've seen it recover somewhat from that, maybe about 60, 65% of the market multiple now, which is still very inexpensive relative to the broader market.
And I should point out to our audience that now everybody is starting to get out and about, and you're joining us from a fencing tournament somewhere in the great state of New Jersey. So
that's right. So if you hear New Jersey in the background, that's what it is.
I actually don't see that as a negative connotation, even though as a Manhattanite, I should find something negative to say about New Jersey. I got nothing, Ron. It's a lovely, lovely state. Did the UAE decision, right? I mean, there was a little bit of a concern on the markets, that the administration was going to get a lot tougher on arms exports, including to the Gulf, which obviously are American allies, even if we may be very disappointed with them about what happened in Yemen. It looks like the F-35 deals going forward and the MQ-9 deal would move ahead as well, barring congressional opposition, although I can't see that at this point. Did the markets look at that as a positive sign?
It might have. I think that was just kind of, you know, mixed up in the wash totally. Right. I mean, if you look at most of the U.S. defense companies and their exposure specifically on those programs to the Middle East, broadly speaking, it's really not all that much as a percentage of sales. So, I mean, of course, it's a positive from a sales perspective, but we didn't get many questions on it.
And anything about the Afghanistan pullout, like sort of dampen enthusiasm, or was that something that many people were baking into their models anyway?
Yeah, I think that was baked in anyway from the previous administration, you know, right. So it's, yeah.
Sash, you normally lead us off on the commercial discussion, but let's talk about European mid-cap defense, as well as news from Babcock and Kinetic, two really, really dynamic companies, you know, UK companies with, you know, doing business around the world.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, this is all tied up. But Europe, it's very interesting. I mean, Ron's talked about the start of a recovery and a re-rating in the US defense multiples, certainly relative to the overall market. And I think his comments about how the US defense sector had fallen to a generational low, I mean, that feels familiar, although it probably wasn't quite as bad for European defense stocks. But last week was absolutely remarkable for the strength of European defense stocks in general. Can't find I can find two that are under or were down by about 0.5%. Leonardo, which is predominant or seen as being civil, even if it's not, Dassault was pretty much flat. But actually, every other European defense stock was up, and the mid caps were absolutely on fire. I mean, Babcock was up over 30%. Hensoldt, the German defense electronics company, up just under 10%, and Kinetic up 7%. Rheinmetall up 4.5%. You know, these are big moves, even though equity markets have become a lot more vulnerable. And, you know, what drove Babcock was a trading statement where they said, we've had a really tough time. Some of our civil businesses are in a bad state. We're going to have to write them off. But, and this was a hell of a but, we're not going to have to ask shareholders to put more money into the company. We can trade through this. We can sort this out on our own. And the fact that the shares are up 30% over the week tells you there are a lot of people betting against the company and betting against the new management of CEO David Lockwood and CFO David Mellors, and who, you know, were just squeezed really badly last week. Kinetic was, it was a less alarming trading statement in the sense that it didn't have $1.5 billion of write-offs of goodwill and so forth associated with it. But actually, Kinetic was at least as positive, because what they said was the overall level of, you know, volume of demand, particularly from the UK MOD for the services they provide, whether that's running ranges, targetry, or actually providing what's referred to as the engineering delivery partnership, where they act as the conduit for a huge amount of engineering services that MOD needs just to keep the ships in the sea, the vehicles on the road, and the aircraft in the sky. Volumes there are still accelerating, and you know that's very, very positive stuff for Kinetic. Our only concern about Kinetic, got to be honest, ended the year the last financial year to the end of March with over £150 million of net cash. It's always worrying when we see a company with that much net cash, because you can be sure it's burning a bit of a hole in management's pocket. They want to go and spend it, and it's pretty hard to find reasonably priced acquisitions. But high quality problem to have. The fact is, for both Babcock, Kinetic, and actually Hensoldt, exposed to the European defense sector, the underlying market dynamics are really strong at the moment, and if people are starting to look at a slowing down of the US defense budget, actually in Europe, our feeling is that defense budgets are running at least 2, possibly 3 years behind the US as a cycle, which means there's a lot further to go yet.
Any update on the Type 31 program? I mean, I should also tell the audience, right, for anybody who doesn't know, Babcock is a very important shipbuilding concern in the UK, winning the sort of third Type 31, right, the less expensive frigate, the export version of the frigate, and a very, very demanding contract to try to execute that and deliver the first ship in 4 years. Any update on that program?
Yeah, this was very interesting, actually. I mean, a real case of no news is good news. The management has been through the, you know, the all the books, every program, every major contract they've got, relationships, the lot, to look for problems, to make, you know, make sure there aren't any problems. And the fact that having done that, Type 31 didn't even make it onto the statement. That tells you management feel, I think confidence is probably overcooking it, but, you know, they feel okay about that program. As you say, it's a very demanding program. We've always thought the pricing was very, very demanding. But I think it's a tremendous positive that given the opportunity, and my God, they had the opportunity, they didn't you know, bring it out, highlight it, take a charge against it, whatever. That's good news. And actually, that puts them in a better position than you might have thought a couple of months ago to win the follow-on to Type 31, which would be Type 32, which is effectively Type 31 with everything it should have had on it, i.e. Right. much greater land attack capability, bigger gun, more missiles, and so forth. And that's the big prize for the end of the decade.
I should point out to the audience also that Kinetic once upon a time used to be DARA, the Defense Engineering and Research Establishment or agency that then spun off Carlyle ownership and then became its own independent company. And I think it's really, really funny that what was the in-house engineering and support establishment for DOD becomes a private company that then serves that same role. I think it's fascinating. Richard, you're going to lead us off on the commercial air travel outlook. Very strong U.S. demand. In fact, I flew for the first time last week to Fort Worth, where I visited Bell. Was a fantastic visit, and we're going to be covering that going into the future. Jet completely full, not a spare seat, flying from D.C. Down to Fort Worth, although the flight back, the late flight, was about half full. Richard, demand is so strong that American and Delta are pulling big planes, usually on international service, right now dormant, and pulling them onto key domestic routes. Sort of bring us up to speed on where we are on travel. What does it mean? And whether it's actually outpacing even your rosy expectations, right? I'm still curious about whether or not we might end up being better off sooner, or does lagging international virus getting worse in India, for example, Europe still teetering, Latin America not doing well, Africa still problematic, right? I mean, so lots of parts of the world are being rocked, even if the UK and the United States and Canada are doing well. And parts of Asia, right? I should give Japan, Taiwan, Australia, you know, New Zealand credit, right? I mean, they're South Korea, they're doing well as well.
Well, first and foremost, Vaga, welcome back to the air. And on behalf of the nation's airlines, thanks so much for flying again. You are precisely the kind of business traveler that we want to see back in the skies. And things aren't looking bad. You know, I think the most important takeaway is where the vaccine comes, air travel recovery follows. This is not a mystery. And I had always said that we're overthinking the recovery. This is what my rather rosy outlook is predicated upon. All we need is the vaccine. The economics are in place. The people are desirous of travel. All we need is the vaccine. And here we are. And, you know, it's the U.S. is half vaccinated in terms of getting one dose or close to it, I believe, something in the 50% of eligible population or 40-something, high 40s. You know, we're at 50% of 2019 levels. Not to say there's a correlation between half vaccinated and half back, but we're leading the way here. We're doing really well in the U.S. And in Europe, Britain is leading the way because it is leading the way in vaccines, too. There's no great mystery here. Now, let's not get ahead of ourselves, you know, because frankly, half off of that traffic peak is still pretty painful for airlines, like any businesses that have a very high fixed cost ratio. They're hurting. Delta, you know, is coming back fast. They also just, you know, said their quarterly loss is over $1 billion. That's not good. And the whole idea of putting twin aisles on domestic routes, that says a number of things, you know. Some people have said, well, maybe this is their way of just, you know, freeing up tons of bandwidth so people come rushing back. Yeah, it doesn't really work like that. Competing on domestic routes with twin aisle jets, it doesn't go well. Now, there might be other reasons. One is they might need to use this equipment. They might need to keep pilots proficient. And frankly, they might be doing a bit of green time rotation, basically taking stuff that doesn't need service because it hasn't been used and replacing stuff that is fast getting into red line for service territory and not having to make that big, you know, overhaul expense. There are a number of reasons why they might be doing this, but none of it is indicative of, wow, a return to fantastic times. The best you can say is that the U.S. is leading the recovery and that there's a very strong correlation between vaccination and recovery. That's all welcome news, but it's not the same thing as a full-throated recovery.
Ron and Sash, your guys' sense on all this? Ron, start us off.
Yeah, I mean, it's I agree with Richard completely. I think, Richard coined the term a vaccine fundamentalist. I mean, it's clear where you see the vaccine, you start to see travel. Now that being said, business travel, my sense will probably lag. Right. When I look at my own situation, traveling for work is still, no bueno. When they'll cut us loose and let us kind of get back to what we used to do, we'll see. I mean, it's going to happen, right? I mean, it's inevitable. But you're definitely seeing, I think, a surge in leisure travel, right? And that's, who doesn't know somebody who wants to take a vacation or didn't just go on vacation or is going to go on vacation? I guess everybody's, tired of being locked up in their homes. But the kind of the next piece, right? And the most profitable piece for the airlines is the business traveler and long haul, right? And, right. Business will come back first, probably, and then long haul will follow, right? And long haul ultimately is more complicated because of the borders involved.
Right. And it also depends on where you want to travel, right? I mean, if you want to travel to Europe, you're sort of screwed. Whereas there are a lot of other options in a lot of other places.
Quick anecdote, Bob, sure. I mean, just for what it's worth.
Sure.
A friend of mine's a travel agent, and I was talking to her this week, and she said, if you want to go to Hawaii is hot. Hotels, prices are off the charts. Flights to Hawaii are booked to the gills because everybody who wanted to go to Europe this summer doesn't think they'll be able to go to Europe. So they all want to go somewhere. So they're all going to Hawaii.
Right.
Right. So, it's the impact of what's going on in Europe in terms of the rollout of the vaccine for sure is driving, demand in different ways for travel.
Well, I think it's funny that our mutual friend Kevin Michaels has a place. His wife is Hawaiian. They've got a place in Hawaii, and you've got to take a COVID test before you go to Hawaii because they don't want COVID to come to the island. And they've been doing that pretty consistently and also managing very, very well their infection level. Sash, let me get your sense on this before we move on to a whole bunch of other things we want to travel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to be the party pooper on this one. First point, the distinction between long haul and short haul, or effectively wide body demand versus narrow body demand, does not apply in countries that are not very, very, very large and have an extremely big domestic population. You're having a fantastic recovery in narrow body demand, to simplify it, in the US, and some of that's trickling through into wide body. But actually, short haul demand in Europe is absolutely dead. And there is this paradox. And this is why I think we've got to be very careful about Richard's, where the vaccine comes, the economic recovery follows. The vaccine has got to come at both ends of the flight, because if it doesn't, you might be able to take off, but you can't land. And a member of my family flew out from Heathrow this afternoon to go to Milan. Terminal 5 was like a graveyard. It was absolutely empty. You could walk through in quick time from drop off through security and into a terminal that had nothing to do in it, because they're not even serving alcohol at the moment, for God's sake. That's the mark of a European market where the vaccination levels are very different in each country. The levels of COVID are very different. It's a short-haul market, Europe, essentially, but every single country is different, and net is bloody awful, even though the UK's vaccination level is up there with that of the US. We've got great vaccination, we can't fly, and therefore the recovery in terms of airlines is going to be a really slow one, even for the UK. which is incredibly frustrating for airlines and airports in the UK, but that's the way it is.
And we did discuss a little bit about, you know, governments making funding available for their airlines to sort of support them because they see that this is not rebounding nearly as quickly as everybody would like to see. You know, how do we address this vaccine passport issue, right? I mean, the U.S. administration, you know, Europe is certainly, and the U.K. is looking toward vaccination passports in order to be able to have some form of surety of travel and reassure the traveling public, and indeed to be able to open up travel. And the United States, that initially had said it was looking to set up some form of vaccination passport regime, has now said, absolutely, under no circumstance are we going to be able to, are we going to do that? We're not going to mandate it, right? But I mean, individuals, certainly if they have vaccination certificates, may be able to use them in order to grease that. How is this going to work? Richard, why don't you start us off, right? How does this work if, you know, right? Doesn't it work if everybody does it? I mean, Alex Dejeuniak of IATA was talking about doing this ages ago in terms of setting up some sort of safe travel mechanism for people. And if we, you know, and probably this is a good opportunity to pioneer it now, because almost every epidemiologist says we're going to be seeing pandemics again in the future. Give us your sense on how we should be approaching this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this has been coming for some time. And, you know, given the fact that there is, surprise, surprise, widespread disparity in vaccine distribution and implementation, I guess that's accelerating the need for such a measure. You know, people aren't super agile about these things, especially since there are a million complications. And, you know, I obviously there's consensus that we need a digital passport rather than a paper passport for a variety of reasons related to verification, authenticity, et cetera. But, you know, people are super good at rolling these kinds of things out. And then, of course, you have to make that transition between verifying on the basis of a piece of paper you were given to get to a digital passport. And given the fact that all of this is effectively a way of rescuing what might be a catastrophic summer travel season. You know, I mean, the idea that we wouldn't have any kind of travel recovery to speak of, at least internationally, in this summer is ruinous for a lot of people in the travel industry. So can all of this be rolled out and implemented in the next 2 or 3 months? It's really super hard to be optimistic about that. It just is.
Sash?
It's going to be Darwinian. You will get yourself as an individual a vaccine passport. You will find the vaccine passport app that works best for the country that you are going to, and you'll do it. I don't think governments will do it. I don't think governments can do it. But airlines are desperate to have some sort of ability to screen passengers at check-in and immigration then at arrival. If you want to come to Europe, get yourself a vaccine, you know, find out what the EU is going to impose, because that will be the de facto standard for transatlantic flights. It's going to be a couple of months yet. I suspect Europe's got other problems than international travel before they even think of bringing these things in. And when they do, I think it's going to be domestic first, international, many weeks in arrears.
I think this is just absurd, because at the end of the day, we mandate all manner of vaccines, whether for smallpox or for anything else. And I don't understand how we, you know, can get away with not mandating something which is a public health threat, especially when so many people may not get vaccinated that they actually may impede the ability of society broadly to get herd immunity. Ron, last thoughts on this? Shifting gears, Ron, I want to go to 737, apparently worsening electrical issues. What do we know and what's it mean? And also talk to us a little bit about your note on Boeing, which did not go unnoticed by the market.
Yeah, so, I mean, two separate questions. So there was an electrical grounding pathway issue. And that grounding pathway issue was with regard to one component, and it seems to have now may impact other components, might be a little more complicated to fix. You know, kind of, it's one of those things where, you know, when you first see it, people say it's not going to be that big a deal. hopefully it's not that big a deal, but you know, as you know, anything on an airplane is complicated, right? There's nothing not complicated on an airplane. It's just sort of levels it's complicated. So hopefully they can sort this out quicker, but you know, the part that's a little bit mind-numbing is this is a program that was, you know, under great scrutiny for the better part of 18 months to 2 years. So how did this one slip through? And then maybe that's a transition to the second question around the note that we published this week. So we published a note this week focusing on the Boeing company from an ESG perspective, but more specifically, not from the E perspective. Everybody's kind of talks about, you know, the impact of aviation on the environment, not from a social perspective. There's a lot of that talk going on, but we focused on the G part about corporate governance, corporate culture, that sort of thing. And we did it in collaboration with our quantitative strategy team that covers, you know, they basically do the ESG work at the firm for the market. And, you know, there's some broad conclusions that kind of come out of it, that, you know, who's on your board, how they're trained matters. Your management culture matters. The culture at the company for your employees matters. And you can show some correlations between that and market performance and so on and so forth. And that was the gist of the note this week. And, you know, sadly, I mean, we went, you know, factually through a litany of issues that the company has run into and, you know, tried to show how that correlates with changes in the company's culture and, you know, changes in the company's governance over time.
And any sense on your part that the company is addressing these? I mean, we've been talking about this on this program for quite a while. Is there sense that the company?
How can I say this? So let me just say some facts. So if you look at Boeing's proxy, I think it was in 2019, they said the word safety, I think, once. And 2020's proxy, it was 160 times. And then the 2021 proxy, it's 146 times. So for sure, they've increased the number of times they say the word safety in their proxy. Interestingly enough, I mean, you know, and that came up in descriptions of board members. So you had some board members who had one description of why they're valuable to the company in the older proxy, and then the new proxy, they were, you know, magically transformed that now they had a safety focus. You know, I think one could argue some of that's just window dressing, but to be fair, I mean, they have tried to address things like having a safety council and this and that, and there is some change going on the board. So, you know, it seems like there's a movement afoot, but an issue that's come up in our conversations for sure is maybe the lack of focus on engineering vis-a-vis other disciplines of the company, that ultimately airplanes are, as we all know, you know, highly engineered products that require, you know, a huge amount of engineering horsepower and intellectual capital. And, you know, was the focus taken off of that for a while for other reasons? And you might conclude that if you look at the way management was compensated and the focus on cash generation in management compensation, because ultimately a lot of this comes down to what the incentives are. And if your big incentive is to just generate cash, that's going to incent you to make some decisions maybe differently than if you had a different set of incentives.
Sash and Richard, anything you guys want to add on this before we go into lightning round and a whole bunch of other things we've got to cover?
No, it sounds a great note though, Ron. And, you know, kudos to you for writing it.
Yeah, absolutely, Ron. And, you know, I think the best thing about it was that it took something that is clearly a pressing social issue or just a moral issue or whatever else and said, hey, what are the quantitative long-term implications of it? And I don't think anyone has done that. And kudos to you for doing it.
Sash, Dirk Hoka, well-respected CEO of Airbus's defense unit, leaving the company. What's going on? What does it mean?
Yeah, this was a bit of a blow. This was announced by Airbus earlier last week, along with some quite significant changes in the management structure of the company in terms of some of the more technical board positions. I think what it comes down to ultimately is that Airbus had a relatively young executive board. And as a consequence, there's just not a lot of upward movement in it, and there isn't a lot of potential for that. And so Dirk Hoecker, who clearly has at least one more big job left in him, and he was at Airbus for 5 years, and I think did a very good job of restructuring the defense and space business to the degree that it has been starting to win business now. I think he just couldn't see the ability to, or the opportunity for the next job. And the next job for him would have been effectively replacing Guillaume Faury as CEO at some stage. But Guillaume Faury is, you know, not going anywhere fast, because he himself has probably got another 5-8 years in him before he would be looking to retire. It's a great shame, because I think Dirk Hoecker had done a very good job as an outsider of improving the culture of Airbus Defence and Space. And he had also invested a huge amount of his own credibility in getting the SCAF program agreed between Airbus Defence and Space and Dassault, and hence between France and Germany. You know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that he fronted up the Airbus Defence and Space side of it in a very, very free and frank discussion of views with the French Parliament. So his successor is, you know, is effectively going to have, not start that from scratch, but this is a program that's still got to be taken through the Bundestag. And I think that it will go a little bit slower through the Bundestag without Dirk Hoecker than it would have done if he'd been able to rebound straight from the French Parliament to the Bundestag and say, you know, we've got the deal at one end, now it's time for you to do the deal at the other. So, you know, the SCAF, Franco-German fighter program, nail-biting stuff, I would say, in the quarter we're in now.
And have they named a replacement, right? Because historically that job is held by a German.
The replacement is Michael Schoellhorn, who was previously the chief operating officer. So they have, you know, that convention has been retained.
And enormous amount of talent, by the way, at that firm, right? And that then becomes the challenge when everybody is in their early 50s. Guillaume, as you said, right, there's no reason for Guillaume to go anywhere at 53 when, you know, he's had the job now for 2 years since Tom Enders' retirement.
Yeah, a lot of talent. And also, let's be clear about it, because this is contrast with Boeing, a hell of a lot of engineering talent, you know, proper engineering management talent at Airbus. And that's why they have made some of the correct decisions about capital allocation, or rather about not allocating capital. And they've managed development programs in the last 5-8 years or so. You know, there's been a real improvement compared to 10 years ago.
Ron, you've got a question for Sash. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sash, were you surprised that Grazia Vittadini said arrivederci as well?
Yeah, I was a bit, actually. And I looked at the statement with effectively, you know, two exec board members going, and it's not a good look. It really isn't. And it's certainly more worrying when you start to lose technology-focused executives as well, because they tend to be harder to get. And actually, from an ESG point of view as well, you know, just retaining a degree of gender balance in any engineering company is harder than for a lot of other firms. So I was surprised at that. I am surprised at that. And proof of the pudding is going to be in the reorganization that Guillaume Faury has put in place now.
Richard, we have been 3-2-1. Richard, let's talk about Korea's KF-21 program, the country's indigenous stealth fighter. Obviously, it's an F-35 partner. I know that over the years, as one of the leading consultants and advisors in this business, right, you've advised everybody from Lockheed to the Koreans to everybody else. But talk to us a little bit about what this program means ultimately, right? What does it mean?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of interesting aspects of this. First of all, and with the disclaimer that yes, we did indeed work up to a few years ago on this project, and it was fascinating working with the Koreans. You know, a couple things. One is that it avoids the big pitfalls associated with other indigenous fighters that have come and gone with dismal results over the years. It's not being done by some state-owned Department of Aeronautical Vehicles operation. It's being done by private enterprise. Second, it's not like, you know, well, they're just building it for one customer. It's got an export orientation from out of the box. You know, it's not like Japan's F2 or Taiwan's Tsingkuo or India's LCA. It's meant to be a global fighter, leveraging Korea's great strength and building good products for a good price for a global market with good product support. So I wish them all the best with that. The most interesting aspect of it, though, is I think they saw what the U.S. Air Force appears to be waking up to now, which is that Gen 4 isn't dead. Gen 4, Gen 4.5, call it what you want. But obviously, General C.Q. Brown and other folks have recently commented that, you know, it's going to be a really long time, perhaps never, before 5th or 6th Gen gets to be the entire force structure. It's just not affordable. We're going to have 15s and 16s and perhaps even some new in the black program that is a Gen 4.5 jet in the force structure, probably for the next half century. And the Koreans are saying, you know, hey, here's a really good state-of-the-art, all modern Gen 4.5 aircraft. I hope you'll buy it. And that's an intriguing approach. Now, of course, there are many issues. Obviously, they have to integrate it. They don't have a lot of experience in integrating mission equipment packages of this this scope. You know, the FA-50 was a nice first step, but this is going to be difficult for them. But if they can pull it off, I think they might have something here.
How does this compare and compete against the F-35 at the end of the day? And does it drive a requirement somewhere else, right? I mean, just because effectively this is the first sort of stealthy-ish, right? I mean, this is a stealthy. It does have a degree of stealth, this new Korean jet, or at least looks stealthy, right? Elements of F-35 in there, elements of F-22 in there. At the end of the day, how does this compete against the F-35? I mean, does it give Lockheed any headaches ultimately, or even Boeing? Thoughts from everybody on the team?
You know, one other thing I'd add, a lot of it does depend upon the price point. And with the F-35A price point being 75 million plus, likely to stay there. That's the sort of sustainable climax state. If they can do something for, 50 million and with commensurate operating costs reduced, that's a good price point to be. Is it as capable as an F-35? Probably not. But, on the other hand, if they focus on the air vehicle rather than the qualities that make the F-35 unique, that might be a selling point too. And finally, there's the F-35, you're kind of wedding yourself to the U.S. And there's a substantial market out there that might not be thrilled about doing that, that might want at least a second procurement track. And obviously the entire Middle East is like that. Even when they do get F-35s, they're still going to want to have an insurance policy in the form of another fighter. They've been going through Britain or France. Could conceivably some of that go to Korea with this modern fighter? Absolutely.
Sash, go ahead.
Look, of course it's going to compete with the F-35 because it's going to compete for budget. It means that the Korean market has shut for the F-35. I mean, there'll be some spare support and so forth, but this is exactly analogous with Tempest in the UK, Sweden and Italy, and with SCAF in France, Germany and Spain. Once you have an indigenous program of this scale, even if it's not competing directly on specifications, it just sucks the budget out. And also, if you are a nation that's doing your own indigenous program, you look at this and you think, if I do this, I keep the jobs in my country. In fact, I create the jobs in my country. I keep the tax in my country. None of those applies when you buy an aircraft from somebody else. So, it's an absolute no-brainer for the Koreans, and I wish them a huge amount of well for it. And this just makes the available fighter world a little bit smaller for everybody else.
Ron?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's going to make life a little harder for the F-18, right? Yeah. So, I agree with Sash 100%.
Richard, you get the last word. A claim from the U.S. that an AIM-120 Delta missile became the longest air-to-air missile shot. We're assuming that that's more than 100 miles because of the Phoenix missile. The AIM-54, if I recall correctly, had a 100-mile range. The Meteor, the pan-European weapon, is more than 100 kilometers, although some people would say significantly more than 100 kilometers. At the end of the day, what do we know about this test and what does it mean? because apparently it was a tweaked AIM 120 missile by Raytheon.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting as the specifics do come out, and maybe not. You know, I have in my mind that it was that combination of the F-14's AWG-9 and AIM-54, I think, yeah, Phoenix, back over, if memory serves, Iraq and the, you know, around 90, 91, that might have held the record, and we'll see if it beats it. I think it was like 145 miles or something along those lines. So this is going to be really interesting. I think the thing to keep in mind is that, frankly, in modern war, or I should say operations other than war, which seem to have prevailed through most of this century so far, not a lot of call. I mean, the theoretical capability for a sort of all-out shooting war contingency is certainly great, you know, but most of the time, air power for decades now has been engaged in civil war intervention, no-fly zone enforcement, everything like that, where this capability is what you might call unlikely to be used, you know, and let's hope we don't have the sort of 38 parallel, everybody firing lots of missiles, all out shooting war that would call for this capability. Still, it's going to be interesting to watch.
Sash, 10 seconds, go ahead.
The claim's baloney. It's just the longest ranged, probably US Air Force missile that's been fired. And, you know, it's very impressive to get that out of an AIM-120. That's great. But, you know, if you look at other missiles, and you've referenced the AIM-54 Phoenix, but, you know, the other contemporary missile out there available to Western fighters is the MBDA Meteor. Meteor is 25% heavier, and it's got a ramjet. Please don't claim that with a conventionally powered missile, you can match the range of a ramjet 25% bigger. Can't be done.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great week and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Vago.
Great to be here, Vago. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.